Metamorphosis is a biological process by which organisms undergo significant changes as part of a necessary period of growth. It is intense. It is uncomfortable. But only through this process can one mature and become something more. My name is Nina Yoshida Nelson. I am a mezzo-soprano. I am a co-founder of the Asian Opera Alliance, and I am an artistic advisor at Boston Lyric Opera. I have performed the role of Suzuki from Puccini's Madama Butterfly well over 150 times, and I am also thrilled to be returning this fall as we get ready to bring Madama Butterfly back to the stage. Through this process, I have gathered colleagues from across the Asian American community to explore the complex and sometimes sticky cultural narratives surrounding Madama Butterfly. Join me as we explore together, grow together, and discover a new butterfly, one with wings to stand the test of time. A year and a half ago, I founded the Asian Opera Alliance. Shortly after its inception, I received a message from today's guest, Phil Chan. In this message, he was welcoming me to the community of advocating for Asians in the classical music industry. He mentioned that he's just a ballet guy and didn't know much about opera, but he had been fielding all these questions from the opera industry for years now, because up until this point, there really hadn't been anyone else within our community talking about these issues. In the last year or so, Phil has become one of my greatest mentors. Anytime I'm unsure of how to answer a question, or have a question myself, or even sometimes I just need someone to vent to, Phil is that person for me. Last season, Boston Lyric Opera hired Phil to curate their year-long program called The Butterfly Process. Together with lots of other Asians and Asian Americans in our industry, we took a deep dive into talking about and potentially solving some of the sticky issues that come up when opera companies are producing Madama Butterfly. You know, it's pretty funny because originally he said he was just a ballet guy, but now after this year of taking this deep dive into opera, I personally would also say that he's an opera guy. So I'm thrilled to be chatting with him today as we discuss Madama Butterfly at the Atlanta Opera. Thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you for having me, Nina. Nice to see you as always.
You too. So you are the founder of Final Bow for Yellowface. You've written a book and you have done a ton of stuff. Tell me a little bit about your career, your path, and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. So I'm a former, as you said, I'm a former dancer. So that's really where my background comes from. And really, I had no thoughts about advocacy or really having this larger conversation at all. It sort of happened by chance. My co-founder for Final Bow for Yellowface, Georgina Pazgogan, she's the first Asian American woman to make it out of the court of ballet and become a soloist, you know, in upper tier ranks in the ballet company at New York City Ballet. And she was sitting in on a diversity committee meeting at the company, and they were talking about the different issues that they had for the company. And one of the things that came up was how the different nationalities in the second act of the Nutcracker, you know, are portrayed. The company had been receiving over the years thousands of letters from parents, from audience members saying, hey, you know, I'm not super comfortable with how these different countries are represented. The ballet was choreographed in the 1950s. And, you know, I'm not comfortable bringing my children to that. And boy, you know, when you're not comfortable bringing your kids to the Nutcracker, you know, that's not a good sign. But Peter also wanted the perspective of somebody who, Peter Martins, the artistic director of the company, he also wanted someone who had the lived experience of being Chinese in America in the minority and could talk about how these caricatures landed on a personal level. So Gina slipped him my phone number. And this was 2017, and we had a quick meeting, about 45 minutes, half an hour even. And we talked about the history of how Asian people have been represented on stage. So not just looking at ballet, but looking at opera, theater, radio, television, political cartoons, film, you know, all of the different genres. And then we also looked at the history of ballet itself as an art form, who contributed to the development of this art form. When we say that these cultures are Chinese or Arabian or French or Russian on stage, who actually got to contribute to what those different cultures looked like? And so from that conversation, he basically agreed to make some small changes to the choreography, the makeup, and the costuming. So, and again, very subtle changes. And so I left that meeting. I called my co-founder, Gina. I said, you know, Gina, I think Peter Martins is going to change the Nutcracker.
Wow.
And in that moment, we realized that we could either just say, well, you know, pat on the back, New York City Ballet, good job for, like, you know, trying to join the 21st century. And then just go back about our, you know, daily lives and posting pictures of our dinners on Instagram. But we also saw that across the field, there was this much larger issue where many companies were doing caricatured, stereotyped depictions of non-Western cultures, non-white people. And so, you know, as our field is pushing for greater diversity, equity, inclusion, we can't just say, well, brown people, non-white people, please join our boards, drop off your kids at our schools, become subscribers and donors. And at the same time, you know, here's a caricatured or outdated version of your history and culture, something that you really is part of your heritage, your identity, means something deeply to you. But here's a flattened version of it that a European thought your culture looked like from 200 years ago, and we're not willing to change it because tradition is more important than your experience. So those two things start to feel incongruent. So we bought yellowface.org for like $11. and we put up a simple pledge that says, I love ballet. And because I'm committed to diversity, equity, inclusion, I'm committed to no longer doing yellowface, caricatured stereotypes of Asian people on our stages anymore. And so it was from there, you know, at this point, you know, 5 or 6 years out, pretty much every major American ballet company has signed this pledge. A lot of the big European ones have as well, like the Royal Ballet, the Australian Ballet, National Ballet of Canada, and the Paris Opera Ballet released their diversity report last year. Actually, the whole Paris Opera organization, and they cited our work by name as a contributing factor to their decision to no longer do blackface and yellowface, which is like sort of insane that here is, you know, this like super conservative old art institution that has this weight of tradition willing to listen and take a second look at what they're putting on stage to make sure that it stays alive for who we are in this current moment. So that's really where the conversation started. And over the years, we had gotten a couple folks saying, well, what are you going to do about Turandot, our production of Butterfly? We're doing Pearl Fishers. What are you going to do about it? And it's sort of like, well, that's, you know, I mean, I could talk about it, but like, I'm sure there's someone in opera who actually can be more intimately talk about their first hand experience. And so when you started AOA, I was just so excited to have other people alongside me in the trenches. And we're having so many parallel conversations just because ballet and opera, they're sort of, you know, conjoined twins separated at birth and then that keep coming back and sort of getting stuck together again. You know, I mean, so many operas feature a ballet, so many opera companies and ballet companies are housed in the same building and institution. And so it's, and they came from the same places, right? The highest aristocratic people of the highest colonial powers, you know, of the world.
Right.
So there is a lot in common between ballet and opera in terms of how we shift this work in this field from being strictly Eurocentric to being something more multiracial and better reflective of who we are as a community today.
Wow. It gives me chills to hear you talk about all this work and everything that you've accomplished. Thank you. So getting into a little bit more about this aristocratic origin of these art forms, one of the most informative lectures I've ever seen you give centers on Orientalism. And I was wondering if you could kind of give us a brief history of Orientalism, what it is, and maybe even how we see it in Madame Butterfly.
Yeah, so Orientalism, and really, if you're curious, you must expose yourself to the scholarship of Edward Said, who is a Palestinian American scholar who wrote, you know, in fact, wrote Orientalism, but also did a lot of scholarship on the process of Europe looking eastward to these exotic cultures. So, you know, so Orientalism really is that, is European Western creators looking outside of their borders to exotic places and using the distance from their own center to project things that might be taboo, you know, or might be opportunities for creativity. So I just finished writing my second book, which is called Banishing Orientalism, you know, dancing between exotic and familiar, which essentially my main thesis is that Orientalism actually is probably one of the greatest drivers of creativity and innovation in the art form.
Oh.
Because when you don't know what a culture looks like, mm-hmm. you have to use your imagination. You're somewhat constrained by reality, right? These are human beings, right. people, but how they dress, their culture, their food, their music, we just don't know. So you get to make it up and break your own rules to do it their way. So whereas we Europeans, we're Christians, we have a certain sense of decorum and social order, you know, stories that take place outside of our boundaries, well, they're not Christian, they're not confined to our rules. So they can do things that are incredibly boundary pushing. So like things like sex, sexuality, mm-hmm. sensuality, women having, you know, some different levels of power and ownership of their bodies, women having less power and autonomy over their bodies, slavery, sexual slavery, you know, incest, drugs, infanticide, orgies, you know, all of these things that were, you know, quote unquote, taboo in Western society, even though Western people have done those things, you know,
right.
across the centuries.
Yeah.
There, if you put it in an exotic setting, it gives us a chance to tell a story about that story or that explore that side of humanity in a safe space.
Right.
The problem with that is that worked when everybody was European. Now we are presenting opera for very few Europeans. So if we here we are in America, mm-hmm. most even white Americans do not identify as European. So we might have some German Americans or Italian Americans, you know, totally a thing. But for the most part, you know, the connections to Europe are just not as strong as, say, if we're presenting opera in Europe.
Right.
So we can say that if we're shifting away from a European center, that applies to most white people in the United States as well. Mm-hmm. That's the bandwagon is for you as well. And it also includes Black folks, Asian folks, First Nation folks, Latino folks. I mean, everybody gets to be part of multiracial. It's not canceling anything. It's actually making the field bigger when we use this approach. Mm-hmm. And it's really just about decentering from just Europe. So that's a big part of my work, both in ballet and opera, is saying, here is this work that has artistic merit, but might have problematic racial stereotypes or dynamics. What else could it be so that we don't change the music or we don't change the choreography, but keep the spirit of what it's supposed to be so the audiences can really have the same impact it did before without uncomfortable racial tropes? So Orientalism in general it was an important device mm-hmm. for ballet and opera, but since we have changed as a society, it no longer serves us in the same way. So it's not exactly the best way to move forward. So and then your question about Orientalism and Butterfly, mm-hmm. you know, you have to think about the context of what was happening in the world when this work was written, mm-hmm. right? So what was the world's perception of Americans, right. American imperialism, you know, and how much of it is still true today, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What was the world's opinion of Japan? How much exposure did we have to Japanese people and culture? How much exposure do we have to American people and culture, right? Those are the two stories. So, and of course, again, centers from a European experience. This is written by Puccini, a European person, mm-hmm. meant for European audiences.
This was before we could travel the world with, you know, exactly. a touch of a cell phone and see what it looks like in Japan and what the cultures are like.
Right. I mean, you can literally go down the street and probably find a sushi bar in your neighborhood, right? Like
yeah.
it's that was not the case right. at the turn of the 20th century. So works like the Mikado, Madame a Butterfly, were a way to travel to Japan and explore that culture from the safety of your own seat in the theater. So the largest problematic issue, I think, with Butterfly is that it projects so much onto the title character, onto Chocho-san, as a stand-in for all Japanese women. Right. There is a sort of a doll doll-like quality, and it's literally in the libretto they keep referring to her as, you know, Bambino, this little girl, this little doll, this little baby, you know, this. And we see that when we zoom out, we see that across many other art forms when it comes to how we depict Asian women as these hypersexual, hypersubmissive little women.
Right.
That actually, you know, from a sexual point of view, just they love to be, you know, had sex with, right, even though they're hyper submissive about it. Like, that's the trope that this opera and other Western fantasies about Asian women, especially Japanese and East Asian women, fall into this trope. I mean, the other flip side of that is, of course, the Turandot, like the dragon lady, right, which also comes with its own sexual appeal.
Right.
But those, you know, for a male composer writing for a primarily male audience, like, that is the appeal. It's exciting. It's sexy. Yeah. You know, it's a little edgy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that is the largest issue is with Butterflies. You know, we're presenting this work, which has incredible music. I mean, some of the best melodies and music ever
written,
you know? So it's not something that we can easily just throw out. And it also, from a commercial standpoint, I mean, everybody knows Madama Butterfly, right? Mm-hmm. It's an easy sell for opera companies to keep doing this work, because even non-opera people know about it and might even buy a ticket to it.
Yeah.
So it's actually like a good stepping stone opera if some of the racial problematic issues can be negotiated some way.
I mean, for me, especially with the way that we consume media today, it's hard to divorce yourself from what it used to be versus what it is now. I think we are so used to, like, now, that it does become a lot more difficult to separate ourselves from that. Especially, you know, opera is in some ways is oftentimes like a museum, right? Like, it doesn't change for generations. You can watch the same production. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I think it's...
I think maybe it's like Shakespeare, right? Like, Shakespeare's over 400 years old. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not going anywhere,
right?
And I think maybe the reason why Shakespeare is still so popular is because we've been able to reimagine the settings, you know, play with it a little bit, be a little subversive. So, like, an all-female cast of Taming of the Shrew, which, like, if you just do it straight, is, like, pretty sexist at face value.
Right.
But that's subversive if you cast an all-female cast and play with it. Or, you know, setting A Midsummer Night's Dream or The Tempest in a crazy location. I mean, we've all seen those, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason why directors, creatives do that is because by changing the setting, it holds up a clear mirror or a different mirror to who we are as audience members, as society, as people, as living beings today. So I think that's actually why Shakespeare is still so popular. Because if we did Shakespeare the way Shakespeare did it straight, people would be offended. It would be canceled. It would be stupid. It would be boring. It would be sexist. It would be, you know, like, it just wouldn't work. And Shakespeare is bigger than that. And we've allowed Shakespeare to be bigger than that.
Right.
And I think, you know, opera, ballet, these other art forms need to maybe let go a little bit and see that if we just don't hold our repertory so tightly, that there's potential to let it have this bigger life.
One of the most controversial aspects of Butterfly, and something that I've heard you mention already, can be, and oftentimes, especially Asian American people, are offended by seeing artists on stage in yellowface. Can you talk to me a little bit about what yellowface is, a little bit about the history of it?
Yeah, so I think there's a little bit of confusion and you know, difference of opinion of some of these definitions. Mm-hmm. So yellowface, as I see it, is an exaggeration, a caricature, a stereotype of a particular race. It is a performed race that is meant to be a mockery. Mm-hmm. So a great example of that is like Mickey Rooney from Breakfast at Tiffany, right? Like, he's doing that on purpose to show that Japanese people are stupid or weird or crazy or, you know, whatever. It's meant to punch down.
Right.
The larger genre of Orientalism, however, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because if a story is set in a non-Western place, the argument has traditionally been, well, we are not of Indian descent. Mm-hmm. So it's theater. We need to, you know, transport people to this magical place. So we paint the skin. We darken our skin to look like Indian people, even though we are Northern European people. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to have empathy for the lead character. You will fall in love with the leading man. You'll feel sympathy for the heroine mm-hmm. as she's dying. And yes, they're all, you know, in blackface, whatever. And we're trying to actually empathize you with people from these other cultures, because maybe you've never met an Indian person, you know? So that's the argument we've seen traditionally uh-huh. from a lot of folks yeah. of justifying why the tradition is not malicious. It never meant to be malicious. It was really just because nobody here is brown and the story takes place in a brown place. Right. So that, you know, it's purely aesthetics. The problem with that is there's so much on stage, off stage, everywhere else that is projected onto that look. You can take it off at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. And also just the larger, you know, inequities that it points out is like, well, you want to do a show that is set in Asia, but you don't actually want to hire Asian creatives right. to execute it. You know, so it brings up a lot of problematic issues. So I think that, you know, exoticism, orientalism, yellowface, I don't think they can all be used interchangeably. We have to be very specific about what we're talking about. And I think a lot of the discomfort that folks are seeing is we pretty much don't do racial caricature stereotypes anymore, like a little bit of ping pong, mm-hmm. but like that's not the main issue I think most people are concerned about. It's when they see white performers performing a different race.
Yeah. I'm just like, you know, the way Butterfly is seen in Japan is totally different than the way it's seen here in the United States. And it has to do with our communities.
Well, I think also in Japan, you have so many representations of Japanese people that are authentic. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, like, turn on the TV in Japan and you've got authentic Japanese representation. Speaking Japanese, you've got good Japanese people, bad Japanese people, fat Japanese people, thin Japanese people, mm-hmm. men, women, kings, queens, paupers, you know, everything in between. Right. You know, whereas in America, when you're in the minority, you get your, oh, I'm the exchange student.
Right.
Or I'm the geisha prostitute, right? Like right. you get a lane and it's a very small lane. Whereas in Japan, the whole road belongs to you. So Madama Butterfly, it's, even if there's culturally insensitive moments or dynamics that don't work, mm-hmm. they just, you know, edit the parts out that don't make sense. Or there's plenty of Japanese productions of Butterfly that have made it more culturally specific to, mm-hmm. to their experience. I don't want to say mm-hmm. authentic, but specific to their experience. You know, but we're Asian people living in the minority. We don't have those representations. So if the only representation is, you know, the 15-year-old geisha who kills herself at the end over and over again, and we don't have these other representations, then that's, you know, perpetuating the problem of, you know, not keeping us out, keeping us Absolutely. Saying, oh, I don't really belong here. It's pretending to be about me, but it's not really about me.
Yeah. I mean, you totally just touched on something that that rings really true to me, because this word representation is something that, you know, I'm really passionate about. I remember when I was a girl in middle school, I was assigned by my English teacher an essay to write comparing and contrasting myself to a famous actress. And I remember going home to my mom and saying, there is not a single person on TV or in the movies who looks like me. And I was like, who do I write about? How can I do this? There is not a single person. And, you know, this is one of the reasons that mainstream media, you know, opera, whatever, that representation is really important. And I mean, Asian, let alone half Asian, I'm half Japanese. Like, it's only been in the last couple of years that I've even seen any half Asian people, you know, in mainstream media. But, you know, I'm curious a little bit as to how what we see in media or on stage or whatever affects the way that we view people in our societies, and why is it important for this representation and this inclusion of a wide range of diversity on stages and on TV? Why is it important to how we interact in our societies.
Sure. So I'll give a personal example. So I grew up in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. which is a pretty homogeneously Chinese society. Okay, mm-hmm. there's some expat Brits and Americans, but it's pretty much like mostly Chinese and a few white people. And I don't think I had, I mean, I grew up in Hong Kong, so I didn't really grow up in a multicultural society like many American places. So, you know, the first black person I ever met was Uncle Remus from Song of the South. You know, the first Mexican person I met was Speedy Gonzalez, mm-hmm. you know, and that's it. That, you know, I didn't have anybody real to mm-hmm. show me a nuance or a more fleshed out version of these people and these cultures. Mm-hmm. So it took some unlearning when I moved to America and actually met, you know, and became friends with non-Chinese and non-white people to unpack some of the ideas about them, their cultures, who they are, who they could be, mm-hmm. Based on what was served to me. And, you know, that's just how I was programmed because that's what was in the media. That was mm-hmm. what was in the movies. That was what was talked about. So I think that if you don't have nuanced portrayals mm-hmm. of people and you don't have them in your community, you know, the stakes are really high to getting those right. I mean, I just see, you know, I mean, think about Chinese people in America, right? Mm-hmm. Probably if you're listening somewhere in small town America, your only exposure to Chinese culture might be your local Chinese restaurant, you know, right. You know, or the Nutcracker, you know, so, and that's it. And I'm just looking at the larger world stage. And yes, we probably will have a large geopolitical conflict with China in the next 50 years in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And just looking at history, you know, and looking at, say, Japanese and American history, mm-hmm. What happens when a big geopolitical conflict happens, you know, and how do we avoid the histories that we've already done in America, mm-hmm. you know, to
learning
Japanese
from
people?
Our mistakes. Yeah.
We could repeat that again easily, you know, and looking at how, I mean, I've been spat on several times during COVID, you know, Kung Flu, the sort of the 300%+ increase in hate crimes against people of Asian descent, you know, as reported by the FBI, like all of these things are already happening. They're already mm-hmm. in the water. They're already in our society. So it's only going to take a little push to go all the way through. And, you know, Nine, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, you sent me, you know, a video, a recruitment video or a propaganda right. video by the American government to justify why we had to round up those dangerous, potentially dangerous Japanese-Americans
yep.
who might pose a threat. And if you look at it from the perspective of someone who doesn't know or who doesn't have a multicultural network or community, mm-hmm. you believe it. It's very convincing.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's terrifying, because it is very convincing. And so I just question our role as artists, as people who repeat, especially repertory, right? We're repeating this opera mm-hmm. over and over again. We're repeating the plays, the ballets, the stories over and over again. That gives them power, you know, doing these rituals over and over again gives them power and reinforces ideas. So as we are, if we know we're going to have this moment where we desperately need to see people of Asian descent with more nuance, more clarity, mm-hmm. More humanity, I want to start planting those seeds now.
Right.
So that when that moment comes, my friends and colleagues and neighbors aren't going to say, yeah, maybe it's okay if we take him away, just in case.
Right. I mean, like, I think in my own life and, you know, these stereotypes that we see, how many times have I been called a tiger mom, right? Or even like in auditioning for Madame Butterfly, mm-hmm. I've been called in before to have a live audition to make sure that I'm small enough. Like, these are these stereotypes that we see on stage. I'm not a big person. I'm tall, kind of, but the fact that that this was so important to a director that I be small enough on stage in Butterfly, that comes directly from these stereotypes that have been, you know, talked about for forever. And so now it affects my life very obviously. And, you know, in Atlanta, something we can't skirt around, the shootings of Asian women just, you know, a year and a half ago, Atlanta's Asian population has more than doubled in the past 20 years. That's just absolutely incredible to me. But one of the things that we have started to realize as opera companies, nonprofit organizations, is the importance of community and our communities. There's been a big push in our industry towards this idea of community. So what is our community? What should we at Atlanta Opera or other opera companies around the world be doing? And more importantly, is this work that we're doing, should we make sure that we're doing it in order to bring in Asian Americans in our community and make sure that we're helping bring in new audiences? Or is it more important that this work that you and I and opera companies are doing, do it as education for non-Asian folk? Where does the balance lie in this work that we do?
Yeah, I think it's got to be a two-pronged approach. One is keeping the Western repertory alive that is popular, that will sell tickets, and hiring creatives who can pose creative solutions to those racially problematic issues, right? So that's the first part. Mm-hmm. In those parts, making sure that we cast with some diversity as well. Mm-hmm. We could talk for hours about casting and strategies. Absolutely. Around that, but making sure overall in your season that you are including a general diversity of people as performers. I'm just thinking about the power of Leah Salonga when she got, you know, Miss Saigon and was doing Les Mis and all these things, right. Just how much pride the Filipino community had around Leah Salonga, both in America and in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, just like the amount of ownership that people were willing to take for a show like Les Mis.
Yeah.
You know, which has nothing to do with the Philippines or Filipino people, but because Leah Salonga was there, you know, like that power is something that we can't ignore in the art form. So that's one side of it. And the flip side of it is also not focusing and centering again on the European canon as the bread and butter. I mean, again, shifting away from a Eurocentric model means that the contributions of Europe are not the only contributions. So finding, new work, underperformed work by non-European artists as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's also part of it. So it's really lots of things happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. Across the field, working in tandem, complementary efforts. It's not just like, well, if we do this one thing, you know, we'll fix all diversity issues. Right. It's a much bigger issue. And the repertory and the casting and who's allowed to present and who's allowed to write and who's on the board and who's the artistic leadership and who's donating money and who's teaching the next generation, all of those things are deeply connected to each other. And they have to all be working in tandem for us to get to the greater equity and diversity that we're looking for in the field so that we're attracting non-white audiences, non-old audiences, the next generation of audiences, audiences from many different socioeconomic backgrounds with different abilities to pay, but all with high levels of passion and enthusiasm and curiosity for this art form. So I think that's what we have to keep in mind, is that it sounds like a lot of pieces moving at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's where the anti-racist, you know, practice and mentality fits in. It's like, yeah, okay, so Nine is doing her little corner of AOA. Phil's doing his little corner, Final Bow. You know, every little opera company is doing their little piece of it too. And if we all just take one collective step together to just do one little thing together, you just see this ripple effect of us all moving in a more equitable and a larger space. So, you know, I think it's happening. We just all have to realize we can't change the whole field, but we do have to do something in our own backyards. You know, like we can't control how beautiful our town is, but we can make sure our lawns look pretty.
Yeah, it's such rewarding work to be doing, and to see that we are actually, you know, creating a little bit of impact here and there as we go along, also getting to create this beautiful art. And I think my biggest takeaway from what you said today is that it's not about canceling it, and it's not about saying we can't do this anymore, but it's more about how can we do this and still be respectful and bring our communities in to this art that we want to share with them. And I just think that's a really powerful message that we can all send to our communities and our audiences. So I want to thank you so much for chatting with me today. This has been really fun, and I hope to see you at the opera soon.
My absolute pleasure, Nina. I'm sure I will be seeing a lot more of you very soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Metamorphosis, a limited series from the Atlanta Opera Podcast. The executive producers are Tomer Zvulun and Ashley Marakian. Matt Dykman is the producer and editor. I am your host, Nina Yoshida Nelson. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way for more people to find our content. And be sure to subscribe so you can stay up to date on new releases from the Atlanta Opera Podcast. The Atlanta Opera's production of Madama Butterfly runs November 5th to the 13th at the Cobb Energy Performing Arts Center in Atlanta, Georgia. You can purchase tickets for any performance at www.atlantaopera.org/tickets. If you are unavailable to join us in person, you can experience the live stream of this production from anywhere on Friday, November 11th, only on Spotlight Media. Learn more at stream.atlantaopera.org.